you talk a little bit about the general concept of which covering hair is a part. Two, for the lawyers among you to discuss the halakhic background. Now, Lily Alcho gave an outstanding presentation, I think it was on a year and a half ago. I'll try to utilize some of the same sources. I'll try to give you somewhat of a simpler presentation, something that'll be a bit more practical. And also, I'd like to answer whatever questions I'm able to answer. So hopefully we'll set aside enough time to answer those questions. But we also emphasize that these areas, to the extent that you do have your Rabbanim and your Mara Diastra, whatever show you belong to, certainly all practical questions should be directed to Halakha, to your particular rabbi. We know the subject for tonight is covering hair, Kisei Sar, or some call it Kisei Rosh, covering the head. We'll see that perhaps there might be a difference there. And in generic terms, this is an aspect of a much broader area of halakha, which is not the topic tonight, but which I can't help but not allude to, and that is an aspect of the law of tzinius. Jewish women have a lot of restrictions that are somewhat difficult for them sometimes, modesty in dress, in conduct, in speech. Covering hair is an aspect of hilchos tzinius, just as dresses and the like. I should emphasize that tzinius per se, which means a sense of modesty, a sense of containment, a sense of staying within boundaries, is not really a unique obligation that is directed to women. The Torah does not say anywhere women have to be tzniistic. Tznius, which is really an attitude and a frame of mind, is something that every Jewish person is supposed to be. We are told in the famous Pasuk in Micha, which I believe is on the cornerstone of one of the famous monuments in Washington. I don't remember which one, maybe National Archives or something. What does Hashem ask of you? What does your God ask of you? Except to do justice, b'hatznei alechas, and to walk humbly. But b'hatznei is the word tznius. Hatznei alechas, es Hashem alokecha. To walk humbly with God. To walk with a sense of limitation. To walk with a sense of humility. To understand that I'm not here to show off. I'm not here to show the world everything that I am. But rather, there's part of me that has to remain inside. This midah of tznius, in fact, applies to men and women equally. It happens to be there's a secondary theme of tznius, and that is because of the male weakness and the male's proneness to be attracted sexually to things that a male is not supposed to be attracted. It happens to be that the burden of tznius falls on the women to some extent, but only because of the inadequacies of men. I mean, it's absolutely clear that the Torah has a very healthy distrust of what men might do in the absence of women behaving a certain way, and therefore women are required. The machitza, by definition, is to prevent men from having improper thoughts and not women. And that is why, in the laws of tznius, generally speaking, there's nothing wrong with a woman, let's say, gazing on a man in a bathing suit. Masha'ein ken, it is considered halachically improper for a man to gaze on a woman in a bathing suit, based on the difference between the man and the female, the way they respond to certain stimulation. The notion of tznius is to de-emphasize externalities. And that is so the relationship of men and women should be predicated on respect and knowledge of each other's essential selves rather than attraction based on ephemeral things, which in the long run don't really make a difference. And in truth, lack of tznius generally means a person has a lack of self-esteem and pride. And a person doesn't really respect what they are inside. And they feel that their connection to the world depends on some external persona that they present instead of their true personality. And that is why, interestingly enough, between husband and wife, the laws of tznius are very much relaxed, because a woman can make the following statement. Part of me is not reserved for public consumption. I make myself available, but only to those who know me, only those who respect me, only those who see me when they see me. They see the godliness within me, and then they can appreciate whatever physical aspects I have in a totality of my whole personality. To the outsider who doesn't know that personality, to the outsider who doesn't appreciate it, they just see physicality, they just see a body. And it's really animalistic to say, I am nothing more than my body. And tznius is really making that statement, that if you want to know me, you have to know me. You can't just look at what I am on the outside. Indeed, it's very common that lack of tznius means a person has no esteem or self-esteem for the true godliness that is inside. We know all of us are victims of Western civilization, and that's in a number of respects. We are victims of the Catholic teaching that has permeated the Western civilization, that women are essentially evil, and if you're holy, you avoid them. The priest avoids getting entangled with women because they are a corrupting influence. They are the source of original sin. Granted, Paul says in the Gospel, well, hopefully I shouldn't really quote it, it's better to marry than to burn, which means people are going to be involved anyway, so God allowed them to marry as a concession to their evil natures. Mm-hmm. Suffice it to say, of course, the Torah utterly rejects this idea. The very first mitzvah in the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply, to have families, to have children. And even if it's a childless marriage, there is a mitzvah, according to many Rishonim, to actually be married. Lo tov hayos adam levado. It is not good. It is not morally proper for the human being to be alone. A human being that is alone is spiritually defective, unless they develop the capacity to enter into a nurturing relationship. So that's one way in which very, very many of us, even the frum, sometimes even more the frum than not the frum, is we've absorbed the idea sometimes that contact with our wives is to be avoided, as it were, and tolerated as a concession to evil, when in fact the Torah regards this as a stepping stone in spiritual fulfillment. There's a second way that our perception has been distorted, and that is, in Western civilization, this is not really a product of Christianity so much, but of Western civilization generally, there's a tremendous emphasis placed on public versus private. That a person's worth is gauged by what they accomplish in the world, how much money you make, how much control you have, how many people are scared of you. That is the mark of a person in the world. And you ask a person, what do you want to be when you grow up? Ask the child, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the child will say, lawyer, depending what age, lawyer, doctor, my brother used to say garbage man, whatever it is. But do you see the subtle misperception that somehow has invaded even the minds of our children? And that is, what you do for a living is not what you are. What do you want to be? The answer is, I want to be a good person who serves Hashem properly. That is what I want to be. How do I want to earn my living? That's the second question. But, in our own minds, and undoubtedly the children have absorbed this from the adults, in our own minds, our very identities are linked up with what we do in the world. And as such, the notion of containment, the notion that there are parts of me that are for me and for God, and are not for the whole world, whether that be in terms of your learning or your understanding or your thought processes or your physical body, that is a foreign notion. Everything is public here. We have the First Amendment. The public has the right to know. My reputation depends on people knowing about me. So the whole notion of containment, the whole notion of privacy, the whole notion that part of myself is not for the public, that is a notion that is foreign to Western civilization. And that is one of the lessons of Tzniut. Now again, of course there are halachic particulars, which I'll get to, and I will get into covering here. I won't talk about all the laws of Tzniut. There are halachic particulars, but the general orientation is that part of me is reserved, part of me is held back, part of me is not for the public to know, part of me is inviolate, and I reserve myself for those who know the totality of myself, and not just the isolated parts of myself. Indeed, the need for boundaries and the need for privacy, to some extent, even exists within a marriage. We do feel, in the perfect marriage, we would think that we should be totally open with one another at all times. Each one should know what the other one is doing. And yet we find, when Rivka met Yitzchak for the first time, and she's coming on the donkey with Eliezer bringing her back, and Rivka was a young girl at the time. Rivka was only 3. According to some interpretation, she was 14, but she was still young. And she was obviously very smitten with Yitzchak. She fell off the donkey. Obviously not just a handsome young man, but she saw the Shechina in Yitzchak's face. And yet we are also told she took a kerchief and she covered her face. This, by the way, is the earliest reference to the notion of covering oneself. In fact, this is the source for the badekin. What does a badekin mean? Before the bride goes to the chuppah, she's veiled. Who is she veiled for? She's veiled from her husband. One of the messages of the badekin is, yes, we're getting married, but I'm still a person. There's part of me that belongs to me also. There is that notion of boundaries and containment, even as between husband and wife. Because although the notion is husband and wife have to become one, but they become one to the extent that each one develops their fullest individuality. It's in the midst of our individuality we can attain that unity, which allows us to truly be one. Again, these are just some of the general ideas that Tzniut is designed to teach. There are particular problems with covering hair. Covering hair is an aspect of Hilchos Tzniut. However, the unique difficulties of covering hair are twofold. Number one, it is the only aspect of Tzniut that only applies to married women. It's a little bit problematical. All the other laws of Tzniut, such as dress and everything else, they apply whether you're married or single. Covering hair is a unique new aspect that kicks in only when one is married. Now, there are some Rishonim, by the way, that say that even single women, all girls, have to cover their hair. There are opinions like that in halacha. But basically, we reject it. Contemporary posts can reject that. So we have to try to understand why is there some new dimension of Hilchos Tzniut that comes in when one is married. A second problem is, if we regard covering hair as the mechanism for containment and not showing off physical aspects of one's body, etc., then people question, why should the shekel be good, right? That are the beautiful wigs that are of human hair, and they might even be nicer than one's natural hair. Isn't it now against the idea of tzniut to wear a beautiful shekel? So again, those are the two particular aspects that are the most problematical, and we'll try to talk about them. Let me just see in terms of some general ideas here. Yes, let me just mention one other idea. There was really a path-breaking book, and maybe some of the feminists in the audience may have read it. Hopefully there aren't any real feminists here, but Carol Gilligan wrote a book called The Different Voice. A very, very interesting book, very insightful book. And again, although it's not from a kosher source, so to speak, Chazal do teach us Chachma Bagoyim Tam, there's a certain amount of wisdom. You have to know to pick and choose, but there's a certain amount of Chachma even Bagoyim. And I believe this is consistent with Torah. She was a psychologist, and she conducted a number of studies showing how men and women perceive reality differently. And she dealt with children. And she pointed out that men tend to perceive reality in linear steps. They see one step at a time, and they master that step, and then they go on. And women, as a general proposition, of course all of these are generalities and there are exceptions, but women had a much more of a holistic relational approach. The example she gave was, you know, a fairly simple moral case where this fellow needed medicine for his son, who was dying, and the drugstore was closed, and besides, the father had no money. So what should the father do? So he asked the typical boy, who has understands morality, and the father was, well, listen, the son is dying, pikuach nefesh. So of course, you take a rock, you break the store window, and you take the medicine. That's how a male would answer, and indeed, that's how I would answer. That seems to be the simple response. You break the window, you take the medicine. Obviously, although it's theft, obviously human life takes precedence, which is good. But she found in her study that women asked a lot of other questions that didn't even occur to men. Women asked, well, one second, wouldn't it be possible, as it were, to leave some money in the store? Why do you have to steal? Why do you posit that the issue is stealing versus saving a life? Who says it has to be that dichotomy of stealing versus saving a life? Maybe you can leave some money. Or maybe you should call up the drugstore afterwards just to say that you're going to come in the next day. Or what if the druggist may have some sick children at home without the money that he'll make from your purchase? How do you know what his situation is? She found, in other words, that women did not just perceive something as a yes or no question. Stealing on one hand versus saving a life on the other, which of course is a very simple dilemma, not really a dilemma, but they saw a much more multifaceted, a much more complicated pattern of reality, which dealt with relationships and how this action affects many, many other people as well. It's not just, you know, my son versus the druggist, but there's a family to consider, and there's even a consideration of, well, what happens if the police come to you and arrest you, and because of what you're doing, you're not going to take care of some other crimes, perhaps some crazy situations. But this was something that appeared to them. And the notion is, we do find that in Chazal, women are more attuned to relationships than men. Women, to some extent, are designed to teach men to enter into relationships. A man is perhaps a naturally solitary being, and perhaps that is because of the male ego, the male aggression. Consider this. I can speak from personal experience. Everybody knows that men hate to stop and ask directions. This is a universal thing. You drive around, and you get lost, and the man will not ask directions. And everybody knows that the wife is always there telling him, let's stop and ask directions. Very trivial perhaps, but very indicative of the notion of the male ego and the male's reluctance to concede weakness and the male's reluctance to go to someone else for help. And women, on the other hand, are more attuned to the notion of relationships. And indeed, the Torah says, why is it not good for man to be alone? Is that good for men, Ron? Because men need... Right. Sorry. Because a man needs the forced association to transcend the egotism which prevents the man from relating to Hashem. When we're egotistic and when we're arrogant, we lose the capacity of relating to Hashem. By going beyond ourselves in a relationship, we obtain that capacity of going to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well. That is the institution of marriage, to teach the human being, teach man in particular, to enter into relationships. And that's why men have minyanim and women don't. You see? Men have to be forced to associate. Get together with these guys, whether you can stand them or not. Daven with them. Interact with them. Relate with them. Transcend your narrow boundaries. You know, in effect, women don't have the institution of minyan because women naturally form communities and associations and getting together. What I would suggest is this. We could look at tzinias, in effect, as the flip side of the forced association with men. Precisely because women are naturally so eager to reach out and connect and expand, there has to be an influence in their avodas Hashem of containment and concealment. The same way that the man whose function might be solitary and egotistic and isolated is forced by the Torah to go and combine, so too for women we have the directives of tzinias, which force a bit of a withdrawal to emphasize the internal, as it were. Each person is given an avodah to kind of go against what comes naturally and what comes easily. And this is the same type of idea. Okay, so that was just a little brief introduction. Just again, it's really just speculative thought, but it might be something that you might find a little bit useful. Now for the lawyers in the audience, let me get down into some of the halachas and some of the sources for the halacha. By the way, if you have heard of this, there's a very excellent three-volume set of svarim that was prepared by Yochim Ellenson, who's got children in accident very recently in Eretz Israel. Mm. And this is called Ha'isha V'Hamitzvos. And there are three volumes about women. It's a collection of sources ranging all the way from the Chumash and the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch all the way to the Tshuvas of Moshe Feinstein and modern people. And one volume is talking about a woman's obligation in mitzvos generally. One volume is about a woman's obligations in a marriage with her husband. And the third is all about the laws of tzinius, covering hair, kolisha, all of these things. And these are very, very excellent sources. And you really get the whole spectrum of opinions from, you know, Machmir to Mekel. And obviously you have to use it with placement to Rav. But I don't believe it's been translated in English yet, but it's really very, very fine. The other one, Halichos Bas Yisrael, which has been translated in English, is also a very fine work. But if you use the work, you know that it's a very strict sefer, and it's based on the prevailing psukim in the Haredi communities in Yerushalayim. So it's a very fine work, but it is much more machmir. It doesn't always present the views of the other poskim, although that is in English. The source of the mitzvah of covering hair. There are really two sources. There's a Gemara in Brachos, and there's a Gemara in Ksuvos. And it's interesting that the concept of covering hair has three different implications. There are three different halachic areas where covering hair is an issue. Number one is, what does the Torah say? What is the Torah's requirement? Number two, there is a secondary requirement that is called Das Yehudis. Das, Dalit Sub. Das Yehudis means the prevailing norms of modesty that are deemed proper for a Jewish woman. There's the Torah absolute minimum. There's the extension of Das Yehudis, okay, which is not a Torah requirement, but it's very important. In fact, the Mishnah says in Ksuvos, if a woman is overes al Das Yehudis, if a woman does not practice the prevailing norms of modesty as defined in the concept of Das Yehudis, her husband has the right to divorce her without giving her a kesuvah. That's the Mishnah in Ksuvos. Overes al Das Yehudis, one is not entitled to a kesuvah, divorce without a kesuvah. That's the second element. The third element of covering here is a separate law pertaining to the recitation of Shema and Shemona Esrei in the presence of a woman whose hair is not covered. Okay? Which means not dealing with the woman's problem, so to speak, but the problem of a man who wants to read Shema or Daven in the presence of uncovered women. By the way, that's a particular problem for rabbis who are conducting marriage ceremonies. Because technically speaking, as we will see, generally speaking, you're not allowed to recite a man is not allowed to recite a bracha at all in the presence, looking at a woman who is not dressed modestly, or a married woman whose hair is uncovered. And alright, so if you're in shul, you don't look at the mechitza, you're okay. But if you're standing in front of a bride or a bridesmaid that is not dressed properly, there's going to be a problem, and you know, we'll talk about how you get around that. Let's take each aspect of this first. What does the Torah require as an absolute minimum? Okay, from the Gemara in Kesuvos, it emerges the following, that when a woman is married, the Torah requires that she not go in a public place, okay? Married woman and public place with her hair uncovered totally. Okay, it's a fairly narrow thing. A total exposure of hair for a married woman in a public place is considered to be a violation of a Torah law. Now you may ask, where in the Torah does the Torah say such a thing? So there are a few sources, but the source that the Gemara in Kesuvos says is, it says by a sota. A sota is a woman that is suspected of committing adultery, and if you recall, there's a whole ceremony that she's brought to the Beis HaMikdash, and she's made to drink water in which the parchment which contained the name of Hashem was dissolved. By the way, the Gemara tells us that to make peace between husband and wife, Hashem says, even erase my name, which you're not allowed to do. She drinks the water, and if she's guilty, she dies a horrible death right away. And if she's innocent, well, she's blessed and she has children and everything else. This is the test, the ordeal of the sota. By the way, the Mishnah tells us that during the Second Temple, they had to stop doing this ordeal. Because this ordeal works only if the man is blameless. If the man accuses his wife, she's caught. But if the man himself is a paramour, the whole test doesn't work because, you know, he's no better than her, so the whole test didn't work anymore. So if she survived, that didn't prove anything. It either proved she was innocent or proved they were both guilty. And therefore, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, this doesn't work anymore. Ramban points out in Chumash, this is the only mitzvah of the Torah whose very existence is predicated on a miracle. In other words, the whole basis of this test is miraculous. Okay, but one of the things it says you do to the sota is, we want her to confess. We don't want her to drink the water. Because if she drinks the water and she's guilty, she's going to die. So we try to make things hard for her, to make her confess. We make her walk around the temple a lot of times, and it says we disgrace her by uncovering and unraveling her hair. Mm-hmm. Para has two meanings. Para means to uncover, and if it was braided, you also bring it out. And this was considered to be a disgrace for a woman, a disgrace that was so powerful that she would confess before this even happened, so this shouldn't happen to her. Interesting. She might not confess before she takes the water. She's willing to die, or she thinks it's not going to work. But when she's confronted with this threat of uncovering her hair, she would confess. So, the Gemara in Kesuvos says, from the fact that we are told that the sota is to be disgraced by unraveling her hair, by uncovering her hair, the lesson is, by implication, see, it's an indirect implication, it's not direct, but indirectly we learn that a nesua, a married woman, is supposed to have her hair covered. Okay? That's the limud. That is the way we learn it. Another limud we learn is, if you recall the story in Shmuel Beis, this is not in the Torah anymore, but in Shmuel Beis, when there was Tamar. Tamar was a daughter of David, and Tamar basically was raped by her half-brother. She had a half-brother, Amnon. Amnon was another son of Beth from another wife. And we are told that Tamar was in such disgrace that after this incident, that she put ashes on her head, she put afer on her head as a sign of mourning. But some interpret that afer can also mean afor. You could read it afor, and afor could mean a head covering. So she put a head covering. Now there you see, you'll see this is really relevant, she put on a head covering. Even though she wasn't married, she simply had intercourse with another man. And indeed, Some Rishonim say, we don't paskin this way, that the obligation of covering hair doesn't only apply to a woman who is married, but any woman that had intercourse with a man, even if it was rape or the like. That's an argument. We don't paskin that that's necessary. We paskin that it don't mean the context of marriage. If a woman was married to a guy, for example, and became a balas tshuva, there's no obligation on her to cover her hair.
How do we know with the sota that it wasn't just disgraceful to uncover her hair in the courtyard of the high priest? and mm-hmm. that everywhere else, like to grocery stores, you could go.
You're right. From the pasuk itself, it's a little different. Of course, it wasn't really the courtyard of the high priest. It was the courtyard of the temple, which was open to all Jews. So it wasn't the particular high priest thing. It wasn't the Holy of Holies. But you're correct. Directly from the pasuk, you don't know. But the point is that the Gemara itself, however, in other words, what I'm saying is not my interpretation. The Gemara itself does say that from Sota, we infer that to go to a Rishus Harabim, to go into a public place, I'll try to explain what that is, with your hair totally exposed, he says that is an Isser Min HaTorah. Okay. That is the Isser Min HaTorah. Now let me emphasize, well, again you have to follow this step by step. We have to talk about what a public place is. Right? We have to define that. And we have to define what is totally uncovered. What type of cover would suffice? We have to talk about that. But first, let me just talk about the parameters of the married idea. Married women have to do it. Well, what that means is, number one, single women don't. Okay, that's the accepted halacha. Although many people say, even single women should not have their hair unbraided, just totally long and wild. It's considered to be proper to have it put up in some way. But single women don't, even if they're reciting a bracha. When a single woman goes to shul, there is no obligation on a single woman to cover her hair when she recites a bracha. Yet men have to wear yarmulkes, women don't have to wear yarmulkes. There is an argument I just mentioned. If a woman had intercourse, does she have to do it? But we paskin not. One issue is, what about widows or divorced women? In other words, in terms of, if they were married Jewishly, does a widow or a divorced woman have to cover her hair? So here, we do paskin yes. We do say that the same obligations that married women have to cover their hair, and again, I'll describe what the covering has to be, this also applies to single, this applies to divorced and widowed as well. However, we do have the following leniency. There is a tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein that deals with the following question. Let us say there was a widowed woman who had a job in an office, and for some reason she made the assertion that if she were to have her hair covered, she would be endangering her livelihood. She'd be giving up her job, as it were. She'd be risking her job. Is there any makom, is there any basis to be lenient in this case? So Rabbi Feinstein said, if what you're telling me is true, now we don't know that, right? But if what you're telling me is true, we could be more lenient in the case of a widow or a divorcee than we would in the case of a married woman. And if parnasa is at stake, then we could permit her, at least in the confines of the office, to have her hair uncovered. He would not have permitted this for a married woman. This is a heter for an almana, a widow, or a divorced woman. Rav Scheinberg had problems with that because Rav Scheinberg didn't understand the question. I mean, what's wrong with the shekel? I mean, what exactly is going to be the situation where if a woman doesn't... There's one thing, a woman can't wear a kerchief or something. But what's wrong with the shekel? But again, I don't know what the facts were, but Rav Moshe does say there's such a heter. I also saw by analogy, some people want to say that if a divorced woman or a widowed woman is going out on shiduchim, on dates, and this would somehow make her more attractive, then you could say the following. If Rabbi Feinstein permits her to have uncovered hair for the benefit of a job, certainly he would permit this for the benefit of getting married again, which is more important than the job. And according to Rabbi Ellison, he said he asked Rabbi Moshe Feinstein this, and Rabbi Moshe agreed orally. We don't have a written tshuva, but Rabbi Ellison said Rabbi Feinstein agreed that for dates it is permitted for a divorce to marry or a widow, a woman. Again, many other Rabbanim differ with that, and many Rabbanim feel, why masquerade what you are? I mean, after all, if you're not concealing the fact that you're divorced or widow, then why should you disguise what you are by taking off? Yeah.
Would that mean that it's only in the context of that kind of dating that she's permitted to uncover?
That's right. If it's not for parnasa or for shidduchim,
but the same divorced woman,
well, I'll talk about what a public area is, but normally, yes. In other words, except where these extenuating circumstances apply, she has the exact same obligation.
It would mean that in one situation she's obligated to cover her hair, and the same woman in another situation might not.
Well, yes, that's right. Well, even for married women, we're going to have certain cases like that. But you're right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. In other words, the idea is there's an obligation to cover your hair, but it can be relaxed in extenuating circumstances. When those extenuating circumstances don't exist, you're back to the obligation.
Because I have heard of people relying on this. You know, in terms of dating, but they tend to carry over that if they don't cover their hair because but if that's not necessary,
I don't think that's true at all. I think that's very incorrect. Because
you don't know where you're
going to
leave somebody.
Well, that might be a situation. Yeah, it's hard to know. If there's a situation where you're going to bump into this guy if you go grocery shopping, then maybe you're right. But as a general matter, you shouldn't be. And generally speaking, I know many chashev rabbanim that advise, listen, if you look at the realities of it, generally speaking, maybe it's prejudice, but divorced women will tend to date either widowers or divorced men. That will tend to be dependent. So after all, everyone should learn to accept each other's situation. After all, certainly when she remarries, she's going to have to cover her hair, so what's wrong with getting the advance on it? Okay, so that's one particular issue about the marriage and divorce. Oh yes. Going backwards, how early in a marriage do you have to cover your hair? Does a kala who's walking under the chuppah, does she have to come with her hair covered? So that's a very interesting point. We know that the Jewish marriage ceremony actually consists of two parts, and they used to be separated by a whole year. Now we do them together. Part number one is called erison. Erison means betrothal. Betrothal is when you give a ring, when a husband gives a ring to his wife, in front of two witnesses and says, Hareyat mefudeshesli, you are married to me with this ring. That is erison. And you know that it was 12 months in the time of the Gemara until the marriage was consummated. She was living with her father all that time. Nisuin is when you have the chuppah and you recite seven brachos under the chuppah, and the chasna and the kala then have a symbolic consummation by going into the yichud room where they have privacy and seclusion there. That's not actual consummation, but we call that symbolic consummation. And that's the second stage of the marriage called Nisuin. It used to be a year. In the time of Rashi, ironically, Rashi was the one who was responsible for consolidating the two aspects of the ceremony. We do them together. We read the ksuba to divide between the erison and the Nisuin. And the reason Rashi consolidated them was for two reasons. Number one, it was too expensive to make two weddings. You used to have to make two weddings. And number two, it was considered to be too much temptation. Remember, this is not an engagement. Once a woman is betrothed, that was a marriage, and yet she had no husband for a whole year. It was considered to be too difficult, so they consolidated it. Technically, the chiyuv of covering the hair comes in only after the second stage of the marriage, and not the first stage. Therefore, the kala under the chuppah does not have to have her hair covered. That's no problem at all. However, when she emerges from the yichud room, at that point she's a new person. She's a nesua. There's the completion of the marriage, and therefore technically her hair should be covered when she enters. Now, there's a difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. And that is, Sephardim, I don't know if you've noticed this or you've been at a Sephardic wedding, Sephardim do not have their yichud till after the wedding meal. In other words, in a Sephardic wedding, you have the chuppah, and they have a few different companies there, they have the chuppah, and then they have the part, then they have the 45 minutes for photographers, that of course is part of the ancient halacha of marriage. But then they rejoin the meal. They don't have this yichud, this togetherness, till after the meal. That's why at a Sephardic wedding, the kala is permitted to have her hair uncovered during the wedding. And this is something people sometimes say, well, gee, I saw so-and-so, who was such a poor woman, who didn't have her hair covered during the wedding. Well, maybe she was Sephardic. A Sephardic woman does not have to have her hair covered till after the wedding meal, because there's no yichud yet. An Ashkenazic woman, or in an Ashkenazic wedding, must have her hair covered when she enters the wedding meal, because there already was yichud. Since there already was yichud, there was no sun.
Just in my observation, it seems to depend on which
the husband. I'll tell you why. This is what Rabbi Yosef is clamoring for. Unfortunately, in the past hundred years, Ashkenaz yeshivas have been dominant. There have been very few Sephardic yeshivas. And as a result, even the Sephardim have learned to Ashkenazi yeshivas, and they have lost their old minhagim.
No, but the other way around, it's among
Ashkenazim. Oh, covering hair?
Yeah, and I've been to many yeshivish weddings where the kala did not cover her hair.
Well, my guess is it's not from the boys' yeshiva, it's probably from the girls' upbringing. That's my guess. She just said what she's going to do.
Right, right.
Isn't
the headpiece that you're wearing, that's what you're supposed to
do? Well, I'll discuss what is a covering. Yeah, never mind. We'll get into the issue of what is a covering, which I'll discuss shortly. Right now, I just wanted to discuss that the obligation of a covering, however that's defined, does come in only when there is the suing, which we define as the yichud, the symbolic consummation of the chatan and the kala. Okay. All right. Now let's get into the next issue. What is a covering? What is a covering? Now again, I mentioned before in the beginning that we have to carefully consider the difference between the Torah's requirements, what does the Torah require, and what is subsumed. Now again, as far as halacha is concerned, this is equally obligatory, but what is subsumed under the next category of Das Yehudis, you know, Jewish moral tznius customs, which are binding on us, no question they're binding on us, but they're not d'oraisa, they're not one of the 613 mitzvahs. Insofar as the Torah requires, most opinions say even a partial covering of the hair would be enough. Insofar, huh? Well, partial covering on top of the head, like a little cap. By the way, this also shows you that the idea of covering hair is not so much to totally cover it, but it's more of a symbolic idea that there's containment and tznius, because some of the hair could be visible. Insofar as Torah is concerned, this is what is called, in the Lashon of the Gemara, Kalasa. Kalasa is spelled Kuf, Lamed, Saf, He, her basket. And it referred either to a little cap, or it referred to a transparent hair netting. There are different translations, a transparent netting, or it referred to a basket, which had kind of a receptacle that covered like the back of, you know, you put in the back of the head. There are different translations, but they all seem to have in common that at least some of the hair was visible. So under Torah law, again, I want to repeat this, I am not giving you the halakha, under Torah law, a kalasa covering would have been acceptable, but the Das Yehudis law goes one step further and requires more. How much more, I'll get to, but it does require more. The kalasa covering is acceptable as far as the Torah is concerned, but the Das Yehudis requires more. Now, how much more? You will find different opinions among the Mefarshim. Certainly, it is brought down that it is preferable that the entire, all hair be covered, that nothing be visible at all. Rav Moshe Feinstein paskens that although it's proper to have all hair covered, but insofar as Das Yehudis is concerned, he permits there to be as much as 2 fingers of hair. And there's a thickness of 2 fingers of hair across the entire forehead, which he allows to be considered uncovered. This is supposed to correspond with a tefach. Now a tefach, as you know, is a hand's breadth, which is 4 fingers. Now you're allowed to have a tefach by a tefach, 4 by 4, but he makes the point that since the width of the forehead is probably two tefach, so if you'd have the square area of a 1 by 1 tefach, that's the equivalent of 2 tefachim by a half a tefach. Therefore, that's how we get the 2 fingers. 2 tefachim by a half a tefach. And Rav Moshe Feinstein says, if you have a tefach or less that is uncovered, he says that is perfectly acceptable, even as so far as the Das Yehudis goes. And he says, even a Talmud Chacham and a very firm person should not argue with his wife if she wants to leave that much uncovered. That is her right to do, provided that she's firm in other respects. That's what he says. This is just what she wants to do. He says that's going to be acceptable.
My question is, why if the Torah requires less, why does the Torah
require
more? Why did
Das Yehudis come?
Yeah, like,
okay.
Why would you make it harder?
Well, the thing is, people. Well, it's a good point, but the idea was people didn't really regard it so much as a hardship. They, in effect, regarded it. Again, maybe it's hard for us to perceive this today. They looked at this as a mark of distinction. It was a mark of nobility. It was a mark to show that, you know, I'm different, or a woman is different. She's special. She's not exposing herself for the public eye. And if you look, even among non-Jews, the concept of covering hair was a very well accepted idea. If you look at pictures. 100 years ago in the United States, a typical God-fearing Christian woman would wear a bonnet. She would not go with the exposure.
But then you're saying your society around you, so as society changes, this instinct,
okay, well,
you know, this should also be changing.
Well, it's an interesting point. All I would say is this. I would say that, generally speaking, we're bound by halachos as they appear in the Gemara. Now, you're right. If later, let's say, certain communities went beyond that, and community did go beyond what I'm saying now, it could be that our communities are not bound by that. But certainly, to the extent a norm has become crystallized in the Gemara itself, until we have the Sanhedrin, until Mashiach comes, and we have a Sanhedrin that is at least as great as the Chachamim of that generation, we're a little bit frozen in that regard. Now, I will say, you will see as I go on, that there were other minhagim that were even stricter, which we're not bound by. but at least the tepach really is as far as you can go. So again, Rav Moshe says that, again, under Torah law, it would seem that even a little covering would have been enough, although it's not clear how much of a little, and very undefined, unfortunately, the kalasa covering, but Das Yehudis requires that the kalasa is no good, you need more, and Rav Moshe assumes that this means, and he's fairly lenient, this means you have to expose less than than two fingers across the entire forehead. Also, many people have said that includes bangs or something, part of the hair that's with the ears, that can also be true. That doesn't necessarily count with the tefach. Even Rav Moshe does say that that the God-fearing thing to do is to cover everything, but he says your husband cannot complain if the wife doesn't want to do that. The two fingers is in the front. Two fingers is in the front. Well, apparently in the back, you can have your two fingers in the back too, but you can't have both. You can't have a front and a back. You could probably take your choice, as far as I can see. Okay, now, second question is of vital importance. Where do these, we discussed what the Torah says and what this Das Yehudis says. Where, what places does this obligation exist? Now here we have a very interesting point. I made the point that the obligation exists only in what is called a Rishus Haravit, only what is called a public place. A public place, of course, includes the street. A public place includes the supermarket. However, in a private place, the Ramah says in the Shulchan Aruch that in a private place, meaning a person's home is the prototype of a private place, a woman has no obligation to cover her hair. Now, this seems to me, and please ask your local rabbi for this, that according to the din, when a woman is at home, she need not cover her hair even if there are other people in the house. As far as, because the point is not if you're alone or not alone, the point is places. This halakha depends very much on a public place versus a private. If you're making a wedding in your house, then of course your house becomes a private place. But if there are a small number of people,
public
place, yes. But if there's a small number of people in your home, insofar as Das Yehudis is concerned, and even the Torah requirement and Das Yehudis, there's no obligation of Kisui Sar in a bias. Now let me emphasize
even
here.
Even
if there's men.
No,
however,
not with the
is this your own home or is this any home? Like your own home?
Even someone else's home. However, let me emphasize this. Let me emphasize this. However, the Magen Avraham says that even though the Torah certainly doesn't require this in a home, and even Das Yehudis only requires more of a covering, but only in a public place, but the custom of Benos Yisrael from time immemorial has been not to uncover their hair in the presence of other men other than their husband. So we have three levels, really. We have Torah level, we have Das Yehudis, which is a Talmudic level, and then we have a further level of a voluntary minhag that Benos Yisrael have accepted upon themselves for hundreds and hundreds of years. Now, the reason I tell you this, and I realize that, you know, perhaps it's not in best judgment to tell you this, is that although by all means I am telling you that in your homes with other men there, it is totally proper to wear a head covering. I mean, by all means, it is totally proper to do so. But the point is that if women sometimes have extreme difficulty with certain mitzvahs, and they want to discuss with the posek what alternatives are available to make the mitzvah easier, I am suggesting that there is a fundamental distinction in halacha between the obligation to cover your hair when you're outside and the obligation to cover your hair in the house, even if there are other people there. And by extension, this is a possible leniency even in a business office, at least if you have your own office. For example, I was approached by an attorney, a young married attorney, who for some reason felt difficulty wearing a shekel. And the truth of the matter is, again, if we clearly understand what is a public place, what is a private place, now we understand that the chiyuv of covering the rosh in a private place does not derive from Torah, and it does not derive from Das Yehudis even. It derives from a minhag, which is of long-standing basis, of course. But again, when there is a makom to be lenient, we have to carefully differentiate in the strata between Torah, Das Yehudis, and long-standing minhag. But again, I do want to urge that as a matter of halacha, it is entirely proper to have your head covered even in your house. Let me just finish this sentence. Even in your house when there are other men present. Now, what if you're in your house and there are no other men present? What if you're alone? What if all you have is your husband? Now there, it comes out the following. If you're totally alone, there is absolutely no halachic obligation whatsoever to cover your hair. Clearly, you're totally free to have your hair uncovered. But even here, where you're totally, there's not even a minute to have your hair covered. But even here, it is brought down that it's meritorious for a woman to have her hair covered, even in the total privacy of her home. And the basis for this story, or the basis for this, is a very famous story in the Gemara Yuma about the Kimchis. The Kimchis was a baker, a woman baker, and she had seven children. Of my home, never the rafters of my roof, never saw the hairs on my head. Because even when I was alone, I never uncovered my hair. And that was considered to be a great schus. Of course, in the Forshim say, it means when she could avoid it. She did wash her hair, then the rafters saw it. But whenever it was not avoid, whenever it was avoidable, she didn't do it. And therefore, this is brought down as a basis for what is called a midas chasidus, an act of extra piety, to always have one's hair covered, even if one is alone, and certainly if one is with one's husband. However, again, Rav Moshe makes the point that, number one, a husband has no right to demand that his wife be an extra chassida. And number two, even the wife should think twice about it if it affects her relationship with the husband. Because shalom bayis is, of course, a primary value. And if it's a question of the wife assuming upon herself a chumrah that the husband, that hurts the husband in some way, then it would not be proper. Now, let me emphasize this too. This was the basis of the Hungarian minhag. The Hungarian minhag is that women shave their hair. Women shave their hair. And there are a lot of reasons why there was such a minhag. This is not required by halacha under any circumstances. In fact, it's brought down in the Gemara that shaving hair is an act of mutilation. One of the things you do with the Eishes Shefas Torah, the woman who's captive of war, according to one opinion, is Vigilchas Rosha, you shave her hair. If a woman becomes a Nazirite, the husband is allowed to annul the Naziris, because a Nazir at the end of the Naziris has to shave the hair. She has no right to do that. But there are a few reasons why the Hungarians have such a custom. One reason was, they wanted to be ensured that the raptors would never see the wife's hair by taking away the hair. It was kind of an assurance that there wouldn't be hair there, or at least no hair would go under the covering. And number two, there were some mikveh reasons, because we know that when a woman goes to the mikveh, it's essential there be no hair that floats above the water, so to ensure that there'd be nothing that would stick up above the water, they had a minhag of cutting off their hair. Now this is a minhag, and of course we can't disparage minhagim, but Rabbi Feinstein makes the point that if a non-Hungarian chassam marries a woman from a Hungarian family, the husband has the absolute right to tell his wife, sorry, you can't do that. And Rabbi Feinstein in fact makes the point that certainly either one could stop the other one if it's not their minhag, because this is a minhag that can affect shalom bayis, and certainly this would have to give way to shalom bayis. So in effect, what we've done is the following. We've identified a Torah requirement, which is having a partial covering when you go in a public place. We've identified a Das Yehudis requirement, which is a norm of tzniyas that's Talmudic in origin, and that is public place, but you need a total covering except for the relaxation of a tefach. We've identified a third strata of long-standing custom that even in a private place, if there are other men present, the hair should be covered. Then we've identified a nidas chasidus, an act of extra piety, is in a private place, even if you're all alone, to have your hair covered. But that already is a level of chasidus. It's not even a staying up. It's not even a long-standing minhag, but it's considered meritorious by virtue of the story of the kimchas. This was taken to the further extreme of even shaving the hair. One other point about this, and that is, we see therefore that insofar as halakha is concerned, when a woman is alone, or even if she's with her husband, there is absolutely no problem, other than the kimchas idea, of having her hair uncovered. The only remaining question is, what about when a woman is in nida? And the reason this is a problem is, the halakha is, when a woman is a nida, any parts of her that are normally supposed to be covered, the husband is not supposed to look at. So, for example, he's not supposed to look at his wife in a bathing suit when she's a nida. Or he's not supposed to see her undressed. Because in the time of nida, there's supposed to be a certain distance from physical intimacy. So the question becomes, is when the woman is a nida, is it proper for the husband to see the hair that a married woman normally has covered? So you'll see different psakim. If you look at the book Halichos Bas Yisrael, you will see that he simply says, of course it's asur. It is asur for a husband to see his wife's hair exposed when she's a nida. However, there's a little footnote that tells you, but Rav Moshe Feinstein, but see Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Well, if you see what Rav Moshe Feinstein says, he actually paskins that it's permitted. He paskins that the only isur for a husband to see parts of his wife that are normally covered are those parts that are normally covered from the husband. But those parts that a husband is habituated in seeing when she's not a nida, he's allowed to see when she's a nida as well. So at least according to Rav Moshe does pass when a husband is allowed to see his wife's hair when she's a nida. But again, he does say if you want to be machmer, it's proper to be machmer in these nida.
I have a question about a lawyer in some sense. She had her own office, and she's putting her hair on top while she was in the office.
Oh yes, that's right. When she went to the courtroom, she had to cover her hair. That's right. But in the office itself, even if people come in, one could argue that's only because of the minhag. It's not considered a rishus harabin.
But wouldn't you say that's more when she's opening her part of her house to people? You know, she's not just opening her house as a private place to people, but she's opening it as making it a public place where business is conducted.
It's not clear that a typical lawyer's office is really a public place, because you know, you can sit in your office most of the day and no one's going to come in. People do knock and they come in. You know, there's a place where people knock before they enter, and it might be akin to a house.
What if you have to
study
in your presence of your father or your brother or a boy somebody?
Let's take that separately. That's a very good question. Now again, depends. Now if you're in public, you have to do that anyway because of the public. But you're talking about a case where you're in your house and it's only because of the minhag. Does the minhag require you in the presence of your father or the like? The minhag seems to require that. Yeah. It's very interesting. I'll think about it some more. If the child is below 9, there's no problem. If the child is 9, it might already be a problem. Not your own children, then.
Not your own children.
Other children, yes.
What about in Holland, just with other women?
Oh, okay. With other women, there's no problem at all. This is only a question of other men, not other women. unless you want to do what the Kimkas did, who always had her hair covered, but that's
what about at home, when either you're making brachos or husband's making brachos?
Okay, I'll come to that.
Well, we're saying,
half a tefach.
Does the hair, does it matter how, the length of the hair, or the, you know what I'm saying? Is it just...
Yeah, it's a good question. It's not clear to me. It seems from Rav Moshe that you're permitted to have an exposure of two fingers of the forehead, which means even if there's hair that extends below that point, it seems that that's okay. In other words, you can have two tefachim of head exposed, even if that means more than that. I'm sorry, half a tefach of head exposed, across two, even if the length of the hair is longer. That seems to be the idea. That's why people say it should be described as kisui rosh. The head is what we're looking at, rather than the hair.
That means the bang.
And that's why the bangs.
And that would be the length. I mean, you can uncover two half a tefach in the back of your hair, down to your waist. That would seem.
That's my question. I'm trying to think. That doesn't sound right. And I'm sure that's not the case. But it seems to me that the logic of the shiva would seem to suggest that. But I'm sure that's not the case. Because the emphasis is the head, not the hair. Well, again, normally that shouldn't be a relevant question, because normally it's proper to follow the minhag that when the other people are not keeping their hair. Suffice it to say that a house is almost never a public domain. Public domain is a pretty narrowly defined idea of people have constant practice about not being. In other words, the fact that people visit you a lot does not make it a public domain.
Have a big party and 50 people
coming,
where do you draw the line?
Well, to tell you the truth, even that would not be a shisa rabbin. Shisa rabbin is a place where people can come without your inviting. So the truth of the matter is, and even my example of making a wedding is not clear that that would be a shisa rabbin. If you're talking about strict Torah law, a shisa rabbin, it's not clear that would be a shisa rabbin. Okay, thank you.
What about
in
the backyard?
That is
an area that
Okay, so again, a backyard would be considered to be your same as your house. But again, I don't want people to walk away with too much leniency. Normally, I am suggesting, even in a private home, if there are other men present, the long-standing custom of hundreds of years is to cover your hair. All I'm suggesting is that if one is confronted with unusual difficulties, this would be the basis of it, to discuss with one's rabbi, the basis of a relaxation. But it certainly should not be an automatic relaxation as a matter of course. The question that Mr. Siegel is asking is, if Rav Moshe permits a widow or a divorced woman who's in danger of losing her job to have her hair uncovered because she needs it for parnasa, why couldn't that be extended to married women who need the money? Let's say their husbands are disabled, or their husbands are learning in kollel, or their husbands are unemployed. Why can't we apply the same heter for them? The answer would be, Rav Moshe would say this, that when you're dealing with widowed or divorced women, the requirement of kisui is not, there's no Torah requirement at all, it's a purely rabbinic extension, and therefore we can be more lenient in rabbinic problems than we can in Torah problems. Although the truth of the matter is, in an office, even for a married woman, technically it would be possibly rabbinic, but there's at least a basis of a Torah law under those circumstances. But let me just get back to the question that was asked, which is really the final component, and that is, the issue I mentioned, that you're not allowed to recite Kriya Shema or Brachos or Daven in the presence of a woman with uncovered hair, or in the presence of a woman? Or indeed in the presence of any woman who's not dressed in Smiyas. Let me explain one thing. This is fundamentally different than the general obligations of Kisa, because this applies, number one, even for your husband, which means even though there's no problem at all except for the Kimchus idea of having your hair uncovered in the presence of your husband is not allowed to recite Shema in the presence of covered hair, because the notion is that it may distract him, uncovered hair, because it may distract him from proper kavanah. And the same thing is with tznius. Although a woman can dress any way she wants for her husband, but the husband cannot daven in that. That even applies in the house, see? So even though it's in only the husband, the iser of saying words of kedusha in the presence of a lack of tzniyos, that applies even with the husband, and even applies in the house. Now, the thing is this. The thing is that does not apply for the woman herself. The woman herself can clearly recite Shema, even if her hair is uncovered. And indeed, even another woman can recite Shema in the presence of a woman whose hair is uncovered. It's only for men, because men will be distracted and the
like. Does it apply to bracha too, or just...
It applies to brachos, and it applies to davening, it applies to kriya Shema, it applies to learning Torah, and some say it even applies to writing words of Torah. Now, if you're in that situation, though, all the man has to, the man can close his eyes and recite the Shema. In fact, that's what the Sadre Kedushin have to do. If I'm a Sadre Kedushin, and I'm facing a woman who's not Tzniyas, I have to close my eyes or turn my face away, look in the sitter, and recite the breath. Is there a question?
I'm just that might be another reason why
That seems to be the basis for the custom that even in your house, if there are other men, you see the problem. You have to have your hair covered, not because of kisei rosh, but because you're disabling them from saying brachos. That could very well be the reason. He can either close his eyes or look away. It's better to even look away. If you can look away in the other direction, that's even better. But when you're Masada Kedushin, you have to face them. Huh? Well, it depends on your side of the yes, that might work. Now, here though, there's a psak. There's an interesting argument between two of the greatest 20th century poskim. The Mishnah Berurah, who of course is the Chafetz Chaim, and the Orach HaShulchan, which was the contemporary Chafetz Chaim, a very, very, very great gadol. And the Orach HaShulchan says the following, and people misunderstand the Orach HaShulchan. People misunderstand them, and he said, and they caught him as saying something he didn't say. The Orach HaShulchan says the following. The iser of reciting davening or shema in front of a woman that's not dressed tzniyos is because it creates, you know, thoughts, bad thoughts in the man, as it were, which take away from kavanah. Therefore, the Orach HaShulchan says, since bisman hazeh, our women don't practice the mitzvah of covering hair. Therefore, men are used to seeing women with uncovered hair. It no longer has a sexually distracting effect. And because it no longer has a sexually distracting effect, men are permitted to recite Shema and Daven in the presence of women whose hair is uncovered. This is what the Orach HaShulchan says. Now you will find that the Orach HaShulchan is quoted as saying, since hair doesn't distract men anymore, women don't have to cover their hair. That is a total distortion. That is not what he says. He does not say women do not have to cover their hair. He says they're doing an avera by not doing so, but it's not going to have the consequence of disabling men from davening. That's all he says. Okay, you will see in certain modern Orthodox publications that he is cited for the other proposition. That is not what he says. The Mishnah Berurah, the Chafetz Chaim, was vociferous against this psak of the Orach HaShulchan. I used to wonder. Now, these were coming out at the same time, and they're really both really great, great, great Sifrei Halacha. And the Orach HaShulchan occasionally quotes the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah never, Chafetz Chaim never quotes the Orach HaShulchan. And, you know, I was wondering why. And somebody told me, this is apocryphal, that the Chafetz Chaim was so incensed at this decision of the Orach HaShulchan that he refused to quote it. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein paskins like the Orach HaShulchan. And Rav Moshe Feinstein does paskin that bisman hazeh, since Bavu Nesenu HaRabim, because of our many sins, he says, women are not careful in the midst of Kisei HaRosh. A husband and even another man is permitted, bisman hazeh, to daven in the presence of uncovered hair if it's not possible to avert his glance or close his eyes or the like. So, by the way, Moshe Feinstein felt, by the way, that he relied on the Orach HaShulchan generally, because the Orach HaShulchan was a rav of the city. He had actual rabbinic experience, and the Chaim was never a rav. So he felt in matters of practical halakha, he actually follows the Orach HaShulchan more often. The Orach HaShulchan was also known to be very lenient in many areas. Perhaps it correlates to the practical experience as well. Yeah.
I've heard that a woman normally closes hair, but her husband should cover her hair while making a rav on the Saturday, and this would be the last time. But he should normally does cover her hair outside the house, but inside doesn't,
No, that's right.
So you should.
Right. So you're following the Mishnah Berurah's opinion.
Right.
That's right.
But it doesn't make a difference if you say Rav in front of other women
who are
really.
Oh, in front of other. Oh.
I'm saying if you're in your house and you have company, let's say you don't cover your hair in your house, but your husband, he can say Rav in front of other women who really don't cover their hair anyway.
I got you. I see what you're saying, but I believe that's incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what you said is certainly correct, and that's the Mishnah Berurah's decision. That even if you don't cover your hair in the house, that the Mishnah Berurah would say when your husband says a bracha or the like, you should cover your hair. That's correct. But if there are other women whose hair is uncovered, even if they never cover their hair, you're not allowed to recite a bracha. See, I see where that mistake is from, because the way the halacha is phrased is hair which is normally covered. You cannot recite a bracha when it's uncovered. What your suggestion you're making is, if you normally don't cover, it's not a problem. But the Mishnah Berurah says right away, that means hair that should normally be covered, whether it is normally covered or not. Yes. No problem. A woman can say brachas with uncovered hair, and she can say brachas in the presence of another woman who has uncovered hair. And the same thing is true with tznias. As long as the woman is not totally naked. She can recite, as long as there's a belt around the waist, it's not just a loose fitting robe, a woman can recite brachos even if she's wearing a bathing suit or the
like. So where did the minhag start of women cutting their hair before dancing up? Even when they're going to the shul. I mean, why would it change? I mean, to me, If you're allowed to go uncovered,
right.
Then why, when you come into a shul, do you have to cover your hair?
The problem might be because men who see you would not be able to recite a bracha. That might be part of the Mishnah Berurah's problem.
Yeah, but if
all men
are not affected,
well,
if the men are not affected, you may know that women are not affected.
You're right. The truth of the matter is, there is really, fundamentally in halacha, although there are customs about covering, there's fundamentally in halacha, there's no particular obligation. A woman to cover her hair in shul.
She doesn't do it any other time.
Well,
unless
it's covered half.
Unless there's a problem of men seeing it, men.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's
the whole thing sounds so backward. A woman is obligated to groom her at all times. So somewhere, at least in shul, where there's a place.
That's a good point. I mean, I guess the attitude shouldn't be. I guess that's a good point. The attitude shouldn't be. Well, if I never do it, why should I do it here? Again, every time you do something right, it counts. So I'm not going to tell you, it's a good point. I'm not going to tell you don't do it in shul. All I'm saying is, shul is no different than anywhere else, but if you feel comfortable doing it in shul, by all means do it, because that way you're doing the right thing, at least in shul, and it should be the right thing in shul, even if you feel you're not able to do it totally elsewhere. So that's a good point.
How do you answer the question about shaykhs?
Oh, okay. What about shaykhs? Now, it's interesting. I'm sorry? Same thing. As far as halacha is concerned, kisui sar is not required if a woman is reciting brachos by herself. I mean, kisui sar is only a problem when there are men there. Now, what about the shekel? It's very interesting. The first mention of shekel is the Mishnah. The Mishnah discusses what women are allowed to wear on Shabbos, jewelry and everything else, and certain things a woman shouldn't wear without an eruv because she may take it off and carry it. So it discusses a woman can wear what is called a peah nachris. A foreign wig. A wig made of, made of straw, whatever they made wigs out of in those days. And, because we're not afraid she's going to take it off, because she's obviously not going to take off her wig in the Rishon Sarab, in the public domain. So here, there are Rishonim that say, this is great. From here we see a very good source that a woman doesn't have to cover her hair with a covering, but a shekel, a wig, is a valid covering. Because we must be talking about married women, because why would single women even be wearing a wig? So we see that married women can wear what is called a peah nachris. However, many other poskim argue with this, because they say this doesn't make a lot of sense. If the wig is attractive as your human hair, or more attractive, or if it's a human hair wig, or what if it's a wig of your own hair? Because those who mock your sheiklich, by the way,
you're not supposed to.
Well, who says that? I don't know. There might be a sheet I didn't find. I didn't find that. The sheets that I saw permit peah nachris even if it's your own hair. If you have a wig made out of your own hair, so you're saying it's not proper. Okay, but the lashon that is said here is it's a strange idea that they say that the yetzer hara when a man sees hair only hits the person with the hair that is physically growing from attached to the woman's head. I would say. that the idea of shekel, again, is going back to Kisui Rosh, not in terms of the effect on others, but the recognition for yourself. It's the notion of self-recognition. But be it as it may, it comes out the following. The Sephardic poskim are against the idea of shekel. And the Sephardic poskim say, a shekel that looks like hair is just as bad as hair, and you have to wear a kippah. The Ashkenazic poskim, by and large, have permitted shekel, either on the metaphysical idea that there's no yetzer hara if the hair is not connected, or on the more psychological idea that the covering is for the woman rather than what men think. Some have said it is proper when you wear a shekel to at least have a hat or a cap on top. That's the Chassam Sofer minhag, where you have the shekel and the cap. Now nobody says you have to have a shekel and cover the whole shekel. Even the most chamor just says you have a shekel and you have a cap. But again, that's not in the Ikar HaDin. In other words, in the Ikar HaDin, the two main shittas are, you either take the position that shekelach are no good at all, and you go with pichel, which is the Ashkenazic, which is the Sephardic pshat, or you paskin that the shekel is good. But again, there are many communities that follow the Chassam Sofer's minhag.
Rosh Hashanah personally, that men tend to wear Rosh Hashanah and have very attractive wives, and she was wearing very attractive human hair shekel. And he said to him that everybody will think that she's not covering her hair. So he said back to him, he said, I don't know why it's a problem for me because you shave your beard.
Right.
And so he said, well, Moshe, how did he say this about me? Of course I wouldn't shave with a razor. Mm-hmm. I use an electric soap.
Right.
What's the difference between people thinking that you're shaving with a razor as opposed to shaving with
You have to give your wife the benefit of the doubt, just as
a man who will give the benefit of the doubt if you use a regulatory order.
Right, that's good.
One question about that should be this, and obviously at a certain point women stopped covering their hair at the household, and somewhere it got lost, something happened. At some point, what happened? That all of a sudden they no longer became people didn't cover their hair anymore.
Well, a lot of things happen. You go back to what happened.
Right,
I mean, we have pornography, and we have all sorts of things which affects the.
No, but as a whole, I mean,
well, I wouldn't say it's a whole. I mean, there are certainly large communities that always kept this mitzvah. But you'll find, for example, and this is a problem I haven't really been able to resolve at all. You'll find among many from German Jews that the minhag of covering hair literally fell into disuse. And that's very difficult because
some lit boxes as well.
And that's very problematic because even if you forget about Das Yehudis, the Torah at least requires some covering in a public place.
The women, when they left their house, always wore a hat. Unless they just went out like this.
Okay.
They always wore a hat when they left the house.
Uh-huh.
But somehow something happened.
Well, if you describe the transition, it might go like this. If you go from tichel to hat. So then, the hat, many people might construe as just being stylistic. Women in Europe wore hats anyway. So then if it becomes stylistic, you discard the hat. In other words, maybe it lost its sense of being a religious symbol when it simply accommodated the fashion. Then it became a fashion, and the fashion could be changed. But again, I can't explain necessarily the sociology of Frumkai. It's a very interesting study. I mean, if you go back 20 years ago in America, Frum families were going mixed swimming. They were doing different things, which some people don't do anymore, some people do, but fewer people do than they used to do. So people say this orthodoxy has turned to the right again, however you describe the phenomenon. When I was growing up, all candy was kosher. Maybe you had that phenomenon. Then I heard candy wasn't kosher anymore. Why certain mitzvahs become neglected is a difficult. I really don't know the answer. And all we can do is look at these halakhic sources and see what they tell us, and we try to follow them. We can't necessarily say, well, it was good enough for my grandmother, who was totally from, except for this thing, it's good enough for me. We can't necessarily make that judgment when it comes to these things. Rabbanus Napshit says in one of his brushes, he lived in the 18th century, and that's when coffee came to Europe. Coffee came to Europe from North America. So he said, people say if it's good enough for your grandparents, it's good enough for you. Well, your grandparents didn't have coffee, and I see everybody's running to the coffee store. Try it out. So you kind of have to do what's right, even if it's a little different than the customs.
Another question about a collar.
You said that after the Yisuin, which is after the Yichud, Kalev Hukliya Yichud to cover for
Yeah.
I was under the impression that until the actual consummation took place, which is like by the next day or whatever, then she is not required to cover her hair. I've been at weddings where the Kalev is actually taken off her the veil because it just got in the way and kept falling off, and they finally took the heck with it and just took it off.
I should say there is a minority opinion. There is a minority opinion that says that until the woman is what we call a ba'ula, ba'ula meaning until she actually has intercourse with her husband, this obligation does not come into effect. And it is a minority opinion. I imagine that one's Rebbe can instruct the woman to follow. But the majority opinion by far looks at Nisuin, not actual deal.
The problem is because
if it's chuppah benida, there won't be consummation for a long time.
Right.
Yeah. Let me just mention one other thing, though, one final thing, which hopefully shouldn't be a major issue for any of us. I mentioned that the consequence of a woman who transgresses Das Yehudis is the husband has the right to divorce her without a kesuma. And in Israel, this becomes real issues, because in Eretz Yisrael, we know that divorce is under the jurisdiction of the rabbinical courts, and they do enforce the kesuvas. And we have cases of men who are trying to get rid of their wives, men who aren't even from, and they come to the Beis Din with the argument, my wife doesn't cover her hair, she's an oberes, al das Yehudis, she transgresses das Yehudis, I don't want to pay the kesuva. And of course, what the Beis Din Paskin is, well, if you're not from, you don't care, are you certain, we're not going to let you use this as an excuse to get rid of her. However, Ravaji Yosef says the following psak. What happens if the husband becomes a sincere Baal Tshuva? Because he married the wife knowing that she wasn't going to cover her hair, but then he becomes from. Ravaji Yosef takes the position, at that point, he is entitled to invoke the halacha of Overes El Das. But Moshe disagrees. But Moshe says that in this time and place, if you weren't from and you married her, you're stuck, you're bound with what you got, and you can't change the rules of the game in the middle of a marriage. That's what he says. And then he goes further, and he says, even if two from people marry, this is an amazing idea, if two from people marry, and the husband did not specifically stipulate that the wife should cover her hair, in this day and age, he says, he has no right to expect that she necessarily would have done so, and he cannot invoke a sanction of Overes El Das and divorce her against the will without a ksuba. Let me emphasize, Rav Moshe is not making the point that she has the right not to cover her hair. She body has to do it. He's making the point, though, the husband cannot say, I expected this, and therefore I'm divorcing it. It's not grounds for divorce today. And there are a lot of tshuvas about women who convert, and when they convert, they have to be asked if they accept mitzvahs, and what if the mitzvah a woman can't do is she feels she can't cover her, she's going to be married, let's say, or she's marrying a Jewish man, and she feels she can't do the, she can't cover her hair. Is that a grounds for not allowing her to convert? There are a lot of tshuvas, and again, though, conversions I've been exposed to, halvai, that would be the only problem. I mean, the conversions that we have today are people who, you know, don't want to keep kosher, and don't want to keep Shabbos, and don't want to do anything. But Moshe is dealing with someone who wants to keep everything but covering hair. And then it depends, really. In Geirus, it always depends. If the attitude is, I understand this is what the Torah requires, and I accept this as something I should do, but I just can't do it yet, that's one thing. If someone has the attitude, that's a stupid mitzvah, Chas v'Shalom, then you can't convert them at all. Because if one has that attitude about any mitzvah, their whole approach to Torah has been tainted, and they are not really eligible for the proper conversion at that point.
Yeah, I guess that also applies to people who are trying to do it, but they can't.
For gay listening?
For people who are born Jewish, but the whole society is not covering their hair, and,
Well, again, let me just explain this. I mean, we've been discussing tonight what halakha requires. Now, I mean, all of us, you know, do things. You know, none of us are perfect. All of us have areas in our lives that need to be improved. And you know, certainly, I'm not here to pass judgment on anyone. I just wanted to give kind of an objective ideal of what the halakha is. And if people have extenuating circumstances, then these are our basis for leniencies under certain situations. For example, if one cannot even keep the Das Yehudis, one should strive to at least keep the Torah requirement of public place having a cap or some covering of that nature. You see, these are severable ideas. That if I can't keep the whole thing, that doesn't mean I don't do anything. The shul thing was a good idea. If I cover my hair in shul, I'm doing a mitzvah when I come to shul. So certainly, you know, there are many things I don't do, and, you know, if anyone is not ready for that, you know, that's their own decision, their own cheshbon ha-nefesh. But in terms of the halacha, it is fairly clear that at least within the first two levels of Torah and Das Yehudis, when you're out in public, there's the obligation to at least wear a cap or some type of head covering. And again, the idea is this shouldn't just be a question of ritual or you know, just something you put yourself through, but it should relate it to the general idea of tznius, of containment, of reserving a portion for yourself and for Hashem and for your husband. You know, even in different Torah, there's an idea of tznius. There was one of the great Baal Musar of the Simcha Zissel who told somebody a vort, you know, some type of insight in the Chumash, and he said, you know, I kept this thought to myself for 35 years. I didn't want to dilute it by giving it away. And there's kind of a notion that sometimes the very precious things in life you kind of have to keep a little bit to yourself. Not selfishness, but a little bit of containment. And it's true with all mitzvahs. If someone's not ready to be shomer Shabbos, you tell them, all right, make kiddush and then go to work. It may sound stupid, but make kiddush and then go to work. Well, kiddush is a mitzvah too. At least you know your Shabbos is special. So whatever mitzvahs we can do, we should try to do. If we're not ready for the whole thing, we'll be part of it. And we're told that mitzvah below is mitzvah. The kedusha, the holiness you get from one mitzvah, pushes you and propels you to other mitzvahs. So I guess that's all I have to say about it. So we can take more questions.
Along those lines of de-emphasizing an external
and well, it's an excellent question. Makeup and jewelry are primarily permitted to make a woman attractive to her husband. That's considered to be a very important norm in halacha in terms of attractiveness. The Gemara says in many cases, shalot tiskana al baal. Many things, for example, when a woman is a nida, the chachamim originally did not want her to put on makeup. They, you know, they didn't want to leave attention, but they figured the attractiveness is important even then. One of the problems with the working world today, men and women, is, you know, women make themselves up to be on the outside, and then in home there's not the same commitment. It's a very serious problem that has been responsible for more than one great one. Primarily it's for the husband, it's not for the outsiders.
In your discussion of the Torah minimum, I'm just wondering what kind of
Jalesa
is that? It's not an
Asa
or a
Lotasa,
it's not...
Yeah, so Moshe describes it, it's a very difficult characterization. Moshe describes it as Pala lo shoisha, the woman's hair should be uncovered, is a mitzvah asay of sotet, right? The positive term for sotet, and we infer the prohibition from the positive, therefore it's what we call a lav haba mechlal asay, a negative that is inferred from a positive statement, and in terms of the mitzvah, that is counted as an asay. A negative inferred from a positive is counted as a positive mitzvah. So in effect, it's a positive mitzvah to cover your hair. The positive mitzvah to uncover your hair of a sotet turns into a positive mitzvah to cover your hair if you're not a sotet. Yeah. Oh, okay. That's not a tznius problem per se. You're dealing with straight melachos, cosmetics and Shabbos. There are two problems of cosmetics. One is salveya. There's a prohibition of coloring yourself. And the other problem is a problem of, you take something like lipstick, which is besides coloring your lips, you're wearing something down. There's a malacha called mamachek, which is smoothing. And basically, you have to avoid any type of makeup that involves that. So generally speaking, in terms of coloring, if you use like a whitish powder or the like, it's not oil-based, it doesn't really stick to your face, so it's not really coloring because it doesn't stick, it's temporary. It's only of temporary nature. And you can't use something like anything that's worn down, smoothed down as used. It has to be powdery makeup that does not have an oil base that adheres to the skin. Now, I'm not an expert in the different brands, but there is something like a Shabbos makeup or the like you have to check. So you have to avoid any type of permanent coloring that you'd have to remove as opposed to wearing off by itself. And you have to avoid any notion of either grinding or smoothing something down.
I wasn't sure I understood the relationship on how much hair
couldn't be left. So in other words, it wasn't how much hair was there, but how much hair was left in her mind.
It seems to be, again, I mentioned that this is a part that is not fully clear from the tshuva, but he seems to be measuring above the hairline.
So
you have two fingers above the hairline.
Is that the hairline that is the woman's hairline, or is that the hairline that would be if she would wear the hairline?
No, I assume the woman's hairline.
When a woman has to have some sort of volume situation, so there was an original hairline?
No, the hairline where her hair actually, where the roots of her hair, the actual hairline.
If we're talking about the scissor tail, we're talking about the roots, the hairs with the erva then, in the blood muscle bone.
Erva for what though?
Erva for the cover.
Well, Moshe says that, the Gemara says the word erva for kriyashma, you can't read kriyashma against the uncovered hair. But Moshe does not call it erva, because it would be an erva mamish, you wouldn't be allowed to have two fingers.
So then where's the
fingers? It's called makamas hamachusim, that's what it's called. It's called places that are normally covered, it's not the same as erva, it's a little less than that. The makamas hamachusim is sheer, the amount that cannot be revealed is a tefach. He does not call it erva. That which the Gemara calls it erva is only because it distracts a person, so it has the same effect as erva. And what you said, it's not going to be erva shochet, but that doesn't apply to it.
How much size? What's the basic definition?
Well, it's very problematical. And the problem is that because we have this combination of minhag and das yehudis and Torah, it's very hard to find precise definitions of each level. But a public place seems to be the streets. And a place where people enter without prior invitation. But again, as I say, it's very, very difficult to find exact definitions of all these terms. The term is Rishus HaRabin does not mean your house, and it does not even mean an office, at least a private office.
I'm sorry, did we mention why
this
is an aspect of things, why it's only
related
to marriage?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if I have a satisfactory answer for that, but part of the idea is that when a woman is married, there's an additional element of tznius that has to be reserved for the family and for the home. The problem really is, what's the idea of a divorced or widowed? Well, why should there be a head covering for a divorced or widowed woman? Why should she be treated any differently at all than a single woman? I mean, she's single. And here, somebody wants to suggest this, that once a woman has had a relationship with a man, she needs the kind of the extra notion of going, getting back into herself. She's already, as it were, given herself away. And therefore, as an antidote to kind of reinforcing the notion that she's private, and she owns part of, reclaiming part of herself, some have suggested there has to be an obligation of kisei, but it's a problem. It's not really clear what the gedorim are. But again, it's especially important for a married woman that the attractiveness and the like have to be part of the total package which she brings. You see, if the attractiveness is just out there for the public, the concept is, so that's all they see. If it's in a family, they see the other part, the more important part. Also, it seems that, I was going to say that hair is considered to be, we use the phrase in English, hair is crowning glory. And hair represents kind of expressiveness. Hair is something that keeps on growing and growing. It represents a certain amount of wildness. Hair can grow even after somebody dies. At least so they say, I don't know. And at least for a while, if there's nutrients in the scalp. And the concept is that part of covering the hair is reining in the wildness and giving yourself discipline and direction and focus. And that's part of the idea as well. Again, a lot of this we don't know all the reasons for. I mean, all of this is speculation. In the Shainu generally, it's interesting. This notion of giving reasons for mitzvos, although the Rambam did a lot of it, the Rambam did it in the Moed Avuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, it was not something that most of the Rishonim were involved in. It's not something that was a major activity of Torah scholarship. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a notion where Torah as a whole was good for us, and we didn't have to understand the whys of everything. And sometimes, when you try to understand things in isolation, they don't make sense. When you try to answer this, some other question pops up. You compare this to shooting ducks. You shoot a duck down, in an amusement park, you shoot a duck down, another duck pops up. Sometimes it's only the totality of Judaism that makes sense, and not the parts. And the sum is greater than the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that might be one way to look at all these things. So, you know, we can offer speculation, but I do have to emphasize it's really just a speculation on my part. Any more questions? No. Thanks very much.
I don't know. I want to be all reactionary.